This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is William Cronin, who is the Frederick Jackson Turner Professor of History, Geography, and Environmental Studies, and the Vilas Research Professor at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. Professor Cronin, welcome to Berkeley.
Thanks for having me.
Where were you born and raised?
I was born in New Haven, Connecticut. I'm an academic brat, so I've lived in university towns all my life. And I spent the first 6 years of my life in New Haven, a couple of years in Lincoln, Nebraska, and then from third grade on through the end of my undergraduate years in Madison, Wisconsin.
And looking back, how did your parents shape your thinking about the world?
Pretty deeply, I would say. My father was an American historian, as I am. I ended up following in his footsteps much more closely than I ever imagined that I would. And from him, I learned the habit of looking at pretty much everything historically, asking how did things get to be this way. And he was a wonderful storyteller and always had historical stories to tell about wherever it was that we might be. My mother was really interested in natural history and science, and those ended up being kind of the converging interests of my life. I'm kind of endlessly fascinated by nature, but I tend to approach nature historically. For me, almost everything has a story in it, and finding those stories is what I've really devoted my life to doing.
And I have the sense from reading about you and reading your writings that being in Wisconsin really shaped you in a very distinctive way.
Yeah, I would say that's true in many complicated ways that ranged from Wisconsin's it's a Midwestern kind of humble landscape. It doesn't have the sublime drama of California. It's rolling hills, a lot of flatlands, a lot of wetlands. It's not a dramatic place, and yet it's also a place where there's a lot of nature and there's also a lot of people living near nature, often natures that other people might not even notice were nature. So there's a lot of farming, a lot of woodlands. It's a culture in which people are outdoors all the time, and that was the world I grew up in. My hobby as a boy was actually cave exploring, and I had friends with whom I went all over the state of Wisconsin trying to find caves and exploring caves, and I came to read the Wisconsin landscape for what was underneath it, looking at the landscape, trying to figure out where caves might be. And that notion that there's a hidden, invisible world, a world that most people don't know how to see, and if you can only learn to look for it, you see things that other people don't. Oddly, cave exploring was one of my ways of learning how to do that.
And I think I read somewhere that in high school, was it, that you did a project on vegetation where you were making note of all the different vegetation?
Yeah, one of the things that a lot of people were doing in the mid-20th century, and I would have been late to this process, but Wisconsin was one of the places where it was pioneered, was they used the original land survey records when the federal surveyors first came across the landscape and put the grid down that turned landscape into real estate in many parts of the United States. And they would cite the trees as they laid down that grid, and it turns out you can use those trees, the trees that marked the corners of the grid, as a kind of ecological sample of what the vegetation in that landscape looked like 150 years ago now. And a high school research project that I did in my junior and senior years of high school was to take a county in Wisconsin, look at all the survey marks, and build a map of what the vegetation had been in that county in the 1840s, 1830s.
I know that you are very focused on the link between history and nature, but it also sounds like the history of nature itself, in other words, its evolution over time.
Oh, yeah, very much so. In fact, I entered college thinking, partly based on the project you just asked about, that I would be a quantitative plant ecologist. And for a while, I thought I would be a geologist. In fact, geology has been a passion of mine, actually, all the way back to those caves. And it continues to be kind of a passion of mine. And in a funny kind of way, geology, ecology, human history, they're all history. They're all the story of landscape change over time. I often think of landscape as one of my favorite words is the word for medieval manuscripts, a palimpsest, in which these very valuable pieces of vellum that the monks would write on were so valuable that they couldn't bear to throw them out. And when they were done with manuscript, they scraped off the letters and wrote something new on that vellum. And you can now read the hidden script on those documents if you know how to do so. And the idea that landscape is like that, that it's layer upon layer of texts that we can read if we know the language, if we have the skills. And the languages come from many different disciplines: geology, ecology, chemistry, physics, astronomy, English literature, you name it. So I'm interested in, yes, the history of nature, and I'm interested in the history of the way we think about nature, our ideas of nature.
You started in photography very early, so the visual is very important for you.
The visual has been very important to me all along. My dad had photography as a hobby, another thing that he gave me. And he actually had an old Kodak 35mm rangefinder camera that I think had been his camera in the late 1940s, early 1950s. And one of my proudest possessions as a boy was when he had moved on to a SLR, much more advanced modern camera, and he gave me this old rangefinder. And I'd say for about, five, six, 7 years, that camera was one of the ways that I would go into the landscape and see the landscape through the frame of the camera's eye. So that, too, is a skill, right? Learning how to see through a lens and thinking through what the lens requires, both technically in terms of exposure, but also aesthetically in terms of composition. And the history of how cameras have that form and the history of why we frame the way we do, all those, too, have stories that I'm interested in exploring.
Also important for you has been the University of Wisconsin, both in the sense that that's where you did your undergraduate training, and it's where you came back from Yale after getting your education, your advanced education at Yale and teaching at Yale. So talk about Wisconsin, you as an undergraduate and any particular professor who really influenced you.
Yeah, well, I was very, very much formed by the University of Wisconsin. And remember, I was the child of a professor there. So when I say I'm an academic brat, there's a way in which I was in the University of Wisconsin from third grade forward in a funny kind of way. So I grew up, my high school was with a lot of academic kids. We were exposed to the university all along. And I would say it's one of the, what you've heard me describe about the interest of people in a landscape has actually been an intellectual passion of that institution, really going back to the 19th century with the initial awareness that Wisconsin is a glaciated landscape and the reading of glaciation in that landscape as a way of understanding, again, the hidden scripts of Wisconsin. Frederick Jackson Turner, one of the best known of the faculty members on that campus in the 19th century with his idea of the frontier, that too had a big influence on me. And as an undergrad, the teachers who most affected me, by far the most important was a man named Richard Ringler, who I almost by accident took a course in my freshman year called the Anglo-Saxons, which was a literature course, but really a cultural history course on Dark Age Britain from the 5th century A.D. to about the 12th century A.D. And he taught that course with pictures and with objects and with a kind of kaleidoscopic understanding of what the landscape of Great Britain had been like during that period, the ideas, the cultures, all of that. And one other teacher in my senior year taught a course on the history of the American West and the frontier. And that's what sort of turned me away from the Middle Ages and toward the American West. And I eventually went to Yale to learn about and then teach the Trans-Mississippi West. But when I got the chance to come back to Madison 15 years later, I chose to do that.
And one of the interests that I like to pursue in my program is kind of how intellectual communities emerge and you know, what are their foundations? And so is it the landscape that you've just described and what Wisconsin's relation to nature that is formative here? Has it been the genius of the leaders of the university so that you get an intellectual community that really reflects this natural environment?
Yeah, it's a really great question, and we could spend the next hour just trying to answer that question, which I know you don't want to do. So a couple quick answers, and I've been puzzling about this question really all my life. I'm quite intrigued why the University of Wisconsin has this kind of peculiar culture. Many other universities that are great institutions don't have the kind of embeddedness in place that place has had. And it's partly leaders. It's partly people like Frederick Jackson Turner or Aldo Leopold, folks like that that people know, or for that matter, John Muir, who we associate with California, but who grew up in Wisconsin, was very much shaped by Wisconsin. But oddly, an institutional explanation, I would say, is that UW-Madison is actually one of the very few universities in the country that is both the liberal arts university and the land-grant engineering and agricultural school. Many, many Midwestern states have a University of Iowa and an Iowa State, or a University of Kansas and a Kansas State. But in Wisconsin, the legislature, actually over the opposition of the Madison faculty, insisted that the land grant, the ag school, the engineering school, be on the same campus as the liberal arts school. And oddly, I think it's actually been that dialogue between the liberal arts tradition, the kind of broad understanding of the human experience, which is the great, I think, contribution of the liberal art perspective to higher education, with the much more practical applied knowledge of the ag schools, the engineering schools, those kinds of professional schools, that really has created a really interesting dialogue at UW-Madison, much of it over agriculture.
And I also get a sense in reading up about you and the ideas that have motivated you that there, this University of Wisconsin setting and Madison and Wisconsin imbue one with a sense of community and community service and the public good and so on.
Very much so. And that's a tradition that goes back really to the governorship of Bob La Follette, the great progressive Republican governor at the beginning of the 20th century, whose roommate in college had actually been a man named Charles Richard Van Hise, who was the first PhD from the University of Wisconsin. And Van Hise would actually write the first textbook on natural resource conservation in the United States. And they were very close friends. And when La Follette became governor, he and his old roommate hatched the idea, which they called the Wisconsin idea, that the university should exist in the service of the people of the state. And the motto of that was that the boundaries of the university are the boundaries of the state. We now say the boundaries of the state, the boundaries of the nation, the boundaries of the world. But this idea that the university exists to serve, that is, it's not in an ivory tower separate from the world, but it is in the world. And being in the world, intellectual work needs to be in dialogue with what's out there in the world. So Wisconsin led the way. It invented the idea of Social Security. There are actually a whole series of public policy reforms in the early 20th century that came out of this Wisconsin idea. And then by the time of the New Deal, we're being mapped onto the nation as a whole.
You then, after doing your BA work in Wisconsin, you took a break from Wisconsin, so to speak, and were a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford and then a graduate student at Yale, and then you taught at Yale. What did you get that was different or additive in these two educational experiences?
Well, that too would be a complicated question. Oxford was revelatory to me in all sorts of ways, and living in England, living in the British Isles was revelatory because this habit of reading landscape that I'd already acquired from Madison, in England, the time depth and the multitude of cultural and environmental layers that take you back from the present day to the Industrial Revolution to before the Industrial Revolution to the enclosures to the Norman French to the Anglo-Saxons to the Celts to the Romans, those layers are all legible in that landscape. And the English, the Brits in general, have had a fascination for that place, I would say, that surpasses most places in the United States. And so it was just a feast for somebody with my kind of curiosity to be in that kind of place with those kinds of guides. And I wrote a dissertation there on energy consumption because I was working in the late 1970s at the time of the energy crisis. But I knew I wanted to come back and work on the history of the American West. And at that time, interestingly, Yale was one of the leading places in the United States to study the Trans-Mississippi West because of a wonderful scholar and teacher there named Howard Lamar. And I came to work with him. He became the dean of Yale College, and I essentially was hired to be his replacement while he was being dean. And what I think I got from both Oxford and Yale that I hadn't gotten from Wisconsin was the idea of, it's hard to describe, institutions that were deeply committed to undergraduates learning in a liberal arts college kind of community setting. So the idea that undergrads were in small communities, which is not Wisconsin's strength, and for that matter Berkeley's strength, is not smallness, it's largeness and the richness that comes from size. Yale and Oxford are much smaller, more intimate places, and I came to have an appreciation for that intimacy of the undergraduate experience at those places, which when I moved back to Madison, I actually tried to set up a residential college at Madison based on the Yale and Oxford models. It was fascinating. Attempt to do that.
And you actually have a paper in which you sort of define what values you would like to see in liberal arts students who really have such an education.
Yeah, it's an essay called Only Connect that was published first in the American Scholar. You can see it on my website. And I actually wrote it at the time that I was working on this residential college at Madison. And in it, I tried to articulate what I defined as 10 qualities of a liberally educated mind that I think of as the goal of liberal education. And that I would say research universities in particular are often at risk to forget kind of very basic things like, you know, learning to read, learning to talk, learning to put yourself in another person's frame of reference and trying to understand the world from another point of view. Those are the civil benefits, I would say, of higher education in the liberal arts tradition. And in the research universities, which I cherish, you know, I am utterly a creature of research universities in terms of my upbringing and how I think of the world. But in the research universities, we tend to narrow our focus. We dive deep, and what we get from those deep dives is extraordinary. But in the world, you need to also be able to open the frame back up and see those deep dives in a larger context. And that, to me, has been the great gift of liberal education to the United States of America. It's one of the things I'm really committed to, trying to preserve that liberal education tradition in the United States at a time when I think it's under threat.
And what is involved? What is the struggle like to implement this kind of vision at a major research university? I mean, what is most frustrating and what is most fulfilling?
Well, again, we could talk a long time about that one, but I would say that if I had to give you two very quick answers to that one would be we specialists, and I'm as much a specialist as anybody, love nothing more than to invite you into my specialty and show you what a wondrous world is in this very small place that I've devoted my life to understanding. And we're often not so good at saying, well, see, here's this specialty and here's this specialty and here's this specialty. What do they share? If we were to have a dialogue across the boundaries, what might that look like? And although we sometimes pay lip service to that, and we certainly say it's important to do, I'm not sure we're actually all that good always to do it. And we often throw the kids, the undergrads, sort of out into this vast menu of all these specialties we want them exposed to. And we kind of expect them to do the integrating rather than us help them do that. And I think the R1s, the research universities, are in general not as good at that as the little liberal arts colleges. They, in many ways, I think, have been the keepers of the flame of that kind of undergrad integration more than the research universities have been. The other thing I would say as an answer to that question is I think the big places, the big research universities, often disempower undergrads without noticing that they're doing it. They often take it as an assumption that the center of the enterprise are the research faculty and maybe their graduate students and maybe the research staff, and the undergraduate mission is not quite sort of the deep, deep purpose of the institution, which is not to say you can't get an absolutely great undergraduate education at a Berkeley or a Madison or an Ann Arbor or whatever, but you have to know how to find it. Whereas a little liberal arts place, I'm visiting Reed College later this week, those kind of places, that's what they do. The kids are the heart of their enterprise.
In a way, one, as an outsider, one sees history as the best hope, in a way, or one of the best hope with the humanities more broadly of preserving this liberal arts perspective. So let's switch gears here a minute and talk about what the skills of the temperament you see of people who want to, students who want to do history and who become historians. And then we'll talk about how the world is changing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure. Well, I'm glad you say that, that history is one of the best hopes of preserving this liberal arts tradition, because I believe that. I believe in the others, too. I believe in philosophy. I believe in literature, all of them. But I would say history, and notice all specialists do what I'm about to do. So a chemist can say this, too. A geologist can say this, too. There's a way in which history is the whole world. There is nothing in the world that you can't ask a historical question about, and the thing you're asking about becomes bigger and deeper and richer by having said, where did it come from? Why is it this way? I would say that one of the habits of mind of the historian is looking at everything in the way I just said. So no matter what it is, whether it's the glasses I'm wearing, where did these come from? Who started making? Why are they made the way? How do people grind lenses like this? When did they start doing that? We can take anything and do it that way. But the second question that historians always ask, and it seems so stupidly obvious that it's almost trite, but when you live inside this second question, it goes forever, is what are the documents? How would I find out where these glasses came from? What are all the glasses that have survived? When did the first lens maker write an account of how you grind a lens? How would I find that document? Where would it be? And that looking for documents, piecing together the kaleidoscopic jigsaw puzzle, which are all these fragments which have come down to us from the past, is really not the way other disciplines ask questions. And so that's one thing that history gives the world. The last one I would give you, though, is historians are committed to ordinary language. They speak plain English. Not that they don't use certain words in special ways, but they're not as fond of inventing neologisms, new words, as many disciplines are. They don't speak a secret language that only experts know how to understand. And so there's a kind of accessibility of historical writing, which if you believe that academic work should be in the world and should be accessible to ordinary folks, that ordinary languageness of history is a good thing. And one reason for the ordinary languageness is storytelling. The commitment to narrative, the commitment to when I answer the question, how did it get to be this way? Well, that invites a story. That's almost a required story is the answer to that kind of question. Most disciplines, although I would argue they all actually build narrative, they build story, they don't actually tell story. The rhetoric they use is not a storytelling rhetoric. And there is something about story, I believe, that is about as deeply a part of human consciousness as any feature of the way human beings make meaning in the world. We make meaning by telling stories. And many of the stories we tell are about the past. That's what history is.
You were the president of the American Historical Association, and in your address and columns you wrote for that office, you talk about a second component, which is coming to understand a foreign country. So in addition to wanting to know how we got here, you really want to answer that question by knowing what it was like back then, but in the terms of the people who lived in that period.
Yeah, and this one's a hard and complicated one because, in general, I would say, more often than not, people who are not historians come to history through the first question. How did things get to be this way? Certainly when I teach an 18-year-old, they haven't lived that much history. They don't have that much time depth in their own life. So, and they have a kind of late adolescence in how did I get to be me? And so there's a way in which one of the most interesting stories is always, well, how did I get to be me? And by me, I mean us. So where did we come from is kind of intrinsically a starting point for storytelling about the past. But for professional historians, we're always a little nervous about that question because it kind of implies that that past back there existed to become us. Its purpose was to become us. And that could not be farther from the truth because those people back there existed to be them, They didn't know they were going to become us. Many of them didn't want to become us. And so learning to recognize that they are equally powerful questions. And in fact, the first one, how do we get to be us, is actually more interesting when you recognize how different those people were back there. And so the way I often put this is the past is a foreign country. Those people back there were really unlike us, even those who are nearest to us. So my grandparents, my great-grandparents, people, you know, kind of deeply in my racial, gendered, classed identities, they are really different from me. And so learning that no matter who they were, their alienness, their difference, their autonomy, the rich selves that they inhabited, I owe them honor. I owe them respect. And asking how that complicated world back there made these really tricky, unexpected journeys to become our world. Well, those two together become one story. But they're not where many people, not everybody begins with the second one. You have to lead them to the second one. That's what professional historians do.
So as you go back and you find this foreign land, so to speak, at the same time, your goal is to figure out how we got here today because of that that foreign land. So the historian has to balance these two things. And are you saying that storytelling is a way to carry this information from the past and bring it to the present so that both fellow historians, students and a wider audience will then appreciate this vocation?
Yes, that's deeply what I believe, and I think it's deeply what my discipline believes. That's the reason why we really are unapologetic about narrative. And many, many disciplines in the 20th century came to regard narrative as unscientific, as not sufficiently ambitious in the generalizations that it had to offer. Whereas there's a way in which history, by its nature, we believe that it's every... although there are broad patterns, each story is unique. And that's the property of storytelling, that if I tell a story well, it's a unique story. You come to care about the characters and the experiences and the lived realities of that set of characters that are in that story. And I do believe, again, that a deep part of human pattern-making, meaning-making, is we empathize with people. We come to put ourselves in their shoes when we can inhabit a story where we can imagine being in that place, in that time. And nothing does that so well as narrative, I would say.
You have an article which is on your website about, I think the article was done for the Wisconsin Historical Society, and it's about a particular place that was became a preserved and was a national, historical site. And you relate that to a woman who lived in the past. I think her name was Juliet Kinsey, who actually wrote a book that described the people and the places and why this house, which she lived in, was important in terms of those stories. So this is a particular example of what you're talking about, that nobody really might care about
right. This
historic site unless we had her stories.
Right, exactly right. And she wrote a book called Waubun, which I think is one of the best accounts we have of life on the Wisconsin frontier in the 1830s. It's in a place called Portage, Wisconsin, which is a remarkable place. I've spent literally the last 20 years working on a huge book about Portage, Wisconsin. It was Frederick Jackson Turner's hometown. It's where John Muir migrated as an 11-year-old boy from Scotland. It's where Aldo Leopold Shack was located. It's the navel of the universe for American ideas of nature. But there's also Juliet Kinsey sitting in what was called the Indian Agency House in the 1830s. And she wrote this book that's not a particularly dramatic or ambitious book. It's about life on the frontier. But she's a wonderful writer. She is her storyteller. She is herself telling stories about the world she's in. And because she's such a vivid storyteller, she sees so vividly and she builds stories so vividly, she's actually one of our best windows onto that world back then. So she becomes a character in my story. And that's, in fact, I think, how history and storytelling work. There's stories that become objects of other stories, and those stories become objects of stories. It's this ever-elaborating web of narrative, which is what we swim in, we human beings.
There's a challenge here and a dilemma. And so and the challenge, it seems to me, is becoming a historian requires learning rigor, learning how to pose a question, learning how to interview, all sorts of things. As one, and actually you explore this on your website, which I highly recommend. But on the other hand, it involves kind of empathy, the ability to write and tell stories and so on, to actually bring out the humanness of what you're discovering. Is this a dilemma, or the rigor of the historian, which might lead to boring texts and long books that people might not read on the one hand, whereas the ideal, and according to your you pose the ideal in your historical address as being people like Michael Pollan, a journalist, and John Sayles, the movie director, as examples of good storytelling. Is there a conflict there or not?
I don't hold them up as the ideal. I'm a great fan of both of them. Yeah. I hold them up as an ideal, yeah. And I contrast their ideal to some extent with what historians are permitted to do. It is absolutely true that John Sayles can invent narratives about the past that I believe convey truths about the past. They're not lies. They're not just fictions, as if that just could do justice to fiction. They're full of valuable insight and meaning, but they don't follow the historian's rules of evidence that you're labeling with the word rigor. Mm-hmm. And it is true that when I write history, I have to follow the rules of evidence of my discipline, or my colleagues and my discipline generally won't recognize that I've made a legitimate claim about the past. Now, I think you can do that in very engaging ways, and in fact, even when I'm arguing, I usually narrate argument. I usually will tell you a story about an argument, and I'll build that argument as if it had a kind of narrative shape to it, a narrative flow. I can tell you a story that will step you through the stages of an argument. But in my discipline, I have to show you my evidence. I have to show you what the basis is back then, some fragment that has survived from back then, that permits me to make the claim that I'm making. And my colleagues in this discipline are very nervous about certain kinds of leaps. Empathy is one of the territories where we get nervous, because if I make an unearned leap and I imagine that I can put myself inside the head of Juliet Kinsey at the Indian Agency House and pretend that I'm her, very likely I will violate her reality. Very likely I will sort of say, well, of course she's like me. She's got the same fears. She's got the same beliefs. And unless I've worked very hard to bound that claim and say, you know, people back in the 1830s did not have that set of beliefs. They did not expect their lives to look that way. And if you take your 21st century assumptions and map them onto her, you're actually describing yourself. You're not describing her. So we work very hard to test those empathic moves. I don't think that lets us off the empathetic hook, though, because ultimately, once you've done all that work, once you've tried to understand her reality, you still have to say, so now that I have this much richer understanding of what it would have been like to be Juliet Kinsey, living on the Wisconsin frontier, this educated New England woman who finds herself, from her point of view, out in the middle of nowhere, what would that have been like? Well, then I can start imagining within the bounds, within the limits of my evidence. And I think I can still make you care about her by doing that. But it's a tricky business.
How do you learn storytelling? Do you learn from alternative ways of doing storytelling, as you did in your presidential address, always pulling back, as you just described, because you're not doing fiction? In the way John Sayles is, for example.
Yeah, no, I would say that. I think that the way I learn storytelling and the way I try to teach my students to learn storytelling is to recognize that it's all story, everything. Story is around you all the time. And when you watch Steven Spielberg tell you Abraham Lincoln's story, when you read David Donnell's biography of Lincoln, or when you read Lincoln's own speeches and letters, they're all different takes on this complicated human being that you're trying to understand. And they're all fair game for trying to say, so that's one way of looking at Abraham Lincoln. That's one way of understanding his reality. And I would say the more different ways of that you pay attention to, one of the things I tell my students over and over again is that if you want to be a writer, if you want to be a historian, if you want to be a storyteller, you need to read not just for content but for form, and you need to read as a storyteller. You need to read as a writer. And another thing I tell them as part of that is that when you're riveted by the story, you're just turning the pages like crazy, pause and say, so why? What's this writer doing that's doing this to me? And conversely, when you're bored out of your mind, when you've turned the last five pages and realize you have no memory of them at all, you've read the same paragraph five times and you just can't stay focused on it, that's actually kind of interesting. It's actually not boring to ask, why is this boring? And so when you read as a writer, even boredom, even a boring text, can be an exercise in figuring out, how does a writer lose track of their audience so much that they bore that audience and the audience stops reading? There's no more disastrous thing for a writer to do than for the reader to go, I'm not coming back to that. So I tell my students to put a 3x5 card over their writing space that says, will the reader turn the page? Will the reader turn the page? And it's the scariest question any writer can ask.
So a student of history should not look at Steven Spielberg's movie and say, well, there are these historical inaccuracies in the thing. I mean, you do that.
You should do that.
You should do that. Yeah. But on the other hand, but you would not then dismiss the work, but see it as a way, well, how did he make Lincoln interesting?
Right. Well, that's one thing. And how did he get us to empathize with Lincoln? Why did he choose in the middle of the Obama administration to tell that particular version of Lincoln's story? How did he create a moral fable that is as much about the politics of the early 21st century as it is a story about the Civil War? Notice, one of the things historians do is we put everything in history. So there is a history of different representations of Abraham Lincoln. And in that story, there's nothing inaccurate about Steven Spielberg's Lincoln, because that's a story not about Lincoln. It's a story about stories about Lincoln. And these days, that story, Spielberg's story, Tony Kushner's story, based on Doris Kearns Goodwin's story, notice the layers of story that are happening there, each of those is an absolutely authentic, totally accurate depiction of what one group of artists in the early 21st century had to say about Abraham Lincoln. We can do that with anything. What I just did, you can do with anything. I joke to my students that even documents that lie, that are total forgeries, are totally accurate documents for the history of forgery and for the history of lying. So if you're writing a history of counterfeiting, counterfeit documents are actually totally accurate, 100% accurate and indispensable for the history of counterfeiting.
You identify in your work and during your presidency at the American Historical Society two really formidable challenges. One is the students and the extent to which their prior education, when you get them in the classroom, may not have prepared them to read, to think, to write, all of the values that you see so important for a liberal education. So on the one hand, there's the challenge of the student body and what we do about that. On the other hand is the challenge of the digital age. And both are leading us away from critical thinking, from rigor, from reading long-form books. Talk a little about that and how we address those two challenges which are related, because the technology is supporting the students in their ability to not have the standards of rigor and of being able to read, of distinguishing between a book and a website.
Well, that's a really deep question, and there were a number of elements to that question that I would want to tease apart a little bit. One thing I would say is that, if we take the classic 18 to 22-year-old undergraduate, which of course is no longer as normative in some ways as it once was as a category, they have always come to college with a whole series of misconceptions and limitations, and the whole purpose of college, I would say, and this I hope will never change, is our job as teachers is to meet them where they are. We can't, it does no good to complain about, well, in the wonderful glory years of the past, students had all these skills they don't have, and that isn't what you just said. But there is a tendency, particularly for middle-aged people, to look back on the glory days of their youth, and kids today aren't like that. And I have no patience for that. These kids bring a wealth of experiences. They bring competences, digital competences, visual competences, that my generation, for the most part, totally lacked. So it's not that they don't bring knowledge. They bring lots of knowledge. But that's where the other part of your question, I think, kicks in, which is they are not used to reading long texts. And I would say, actually, most adults are no longer all that used to reading long texts. We are now, all of us, spending more and more of our time in chopped up, bloggy, tweety, Facebooky, very short units of information, which by their nature are radically decontextualized. And the experience of the search engine, the Google experience, is that when we need information, our dominant metaphor now is, I grab the information and I grab it and it's this big. And in grabbing it, the way I just grabbed it, I ripped it out of the context that it was in, and I didn't actually have to work very hard to extract it from that context. One of the things historians believe strongly is that that struggle to find this piece of information, and it's buried in this tangle, and as we work our way into the tangle to figure it out, we learn not just the piece of information, we learn the tangle. And it's the tangle that educates our intuitions and gives us this kind of rich intuitive knowledge about what that world was like. And I would say kids today, like most of us today, are more impatient. We want things quickly. I regularly, this astonishes me, this never used to happen. I now regularly get emails. That's the other thing, we think we can just email people for information rather than find it ourselves. I get emails from undergraduates, and I kid you not, I get more than one or two of these a month. And the kid says, literally, my professor has assigned me to write a book report about your book. Can you tell me what it's about? and the kid is not trying to cheat. They don't think that they're doing something wrong. And I don't want to be snarky. I'm a teacher to them, too. You know, my job is to meet them where they are. And this is a student who thought that the way you write a book report is contact the author and ask the author what the book's about. Never in a million years would that have occurred to me as an undergraduate. But, of course, it's so easy now. So I have to very gently and as kindly as I can say, you know, the answer to your question is in my book. You might want to read it. And, you know, it's changing that way of thinking, that idea that you don't have a primary experience of reality. You have a virtual experience of reality, and a Wikipedia summary is all you need as a way of accessing that reality. So there's some complicated changes going on.
Historians, in a way, are positioned to adapt to the web, even though they may resist the web. And I draw this conclusion from your emphasis on storytelling and also what you've written about your teachers, you know, and the way they might use pictures or multimedia. And in the classroom, they are having to articulate their research in ways that students can understand and we will be enthralled by. So in a way, teaching and storytelling are a stepping stone to move into the digital age. Historians just have to think about it.
I think that's right. One advantage, it's a vice virtue thing. One of our virtues is that we do think in stories. Stories are accessible. We write in ordinary language. Another advantage is that almost alone, not quite alone, but almost alone among the academic disciplines, we're still a book discipline. The vast majority of academic disciplines now have their principal intellectual output in academic journals, which, notice, have the interesting attribute that they don't need to assemble their audiences. The audience is already pre-assembled. The group of specialists is gathered around that journal. And the goal is the most efficient communication of new findings to that expert audience. So there's not a problem of translation. You've already got the experts, and you want to get it to them as quickly as possible. They don't want to be bored with explication because they already know the context. Whereas when you write a book, you have no guaranteed audience. Every book has to build its own audience. It has to create its own audience. And so the narrative act of imagining the other to whom you're communicating and the commitment of my discipline to ordinary language, when I write a book, I do not just want my colleagues to read it. I want anybody who's interested to feel intrigued by the invitation I'm giving them to come into this really cool space that I want to share with them. That's the virtue. To finish, though, with the vice, we like books. The default of my discipline, we're never so happy as when we can write a 250 to 500 page book to tell you a long, long story about what happened back then. And that is not the way most people now read. Long, long reading, particularly long, complicated, technical, demanding reading, is less and less common as an act of pleasure. So I would say that the biggest deficit, as I experience it, that my undergraduates now bring into the classroom is many of them, no longer read long books for pleasure. It's not part of their lived reality that you would pick up. And we always name Harry Potter, but I think Harry Potter is the exception to prove the rule. And Rowling is a genius at the narrative momentum that she can use to suck people up and carry them for 800 pages. That's not the way most books work. So persuading kids that reading long is still a valuable thing to do is hard work. And here now I'll finally answer your question in this way. One of the things I believe, and I don't think this comes naturally to my discipline, but it does come naturally to storytelling, is that there's a way in which any story can be told at any length. I can tell you Anna Karenina in 800 pages. I can summarize it for you in 100 pages. I can summarize it in a paragraph. I can, in fact, tweet it. And I can capture a reality about that book. Now, if I tweet it, you're losing an awful lot of Tolstoy when I do that. But remembering that all narrative is scalable, it loses richness and subtlety and complexity as you scale it down. But I do think that that's the lesson of the digital age. We need to learn how to tell our narratives, construct our arguments, put things in the public realm on multi-scales. And my anxiety, one of my missions in the time I have left to me, is to try to keep defending the long form, the full-length Anna Karenina, say. It's just a fictional metaphor for long narrative. At the same time that I'm trying to help me and my colleagues get our work out into the blogosphere, get it out into Facebook, get it out into the much smaller units of argumentation, or for that matter, in multimedia, on television, in video, the space that we're in right now, that YouTube has opened up this kind of conversation in a way that was never possible before. When you began these interviews, they were nowhere near as accessible to the world as they are now. And that's a wondrous thing. It's an amazing thing. You and I can talk for an hour, and there will be people all around the world that can access it. That's something that never before could have been done. And we need to lean into that the way you've been leaning into it.
Thank you. Let's talk a little about environmental history, because you are a leading figure in environmental history. And what does history bring to our understanding of the environment. You, at one point, I think I read where you said that one's goal as an environmental historian is to bring nature into history, basically. Talk a little about that.
Environmental history is the history of human beings' interactions with the natural world over time. It's the history of environmental politics. It's the history of our changing ideas of nature. And one of the interesting things about our ideas of nature, taking the United States as the frame, as I typically do, I'm a U.S. historian. I work largely in the geography of the United States. Nature in the United States has often been a kind of romantic early 19th century nature, which is static and stable, beautiful, equilibrated, whole. And there is a story that Americans have often told themselves, and that I would say environmentalists still tell themselves, in which the human past is a story of our taking that stable nature and transforming it. And a story that was very important to American history was the story of progress, in which we take a savage wilderness, raw nature, and convert it into civilization, convert it into progress. That's Frederick Jackson Turner's story of the American frontier, which has all sorts of erasures, and Native peoples have a very awkward place in that particular narrative. There's an environmental story, which as often as not says that nature was good and whole before we got our hands on it, and boy, have we trashed it. And the story is a story of a fall from that nature. Both of those are human ideas. Both of those stories say as much about us as they do about nature. So what environmental history seeks to do is to call our attention to a world out there of non-human beings and processes, landscapes, environments that we could not exist without. Our lives utterly, utterly depend on all those relationships. And yet, much of the time, we pay no attention to them at all, or we put ourselves at the center of the story and ignore all those beings with whom we share this planet. And I think the great achievement of environmental history has been to say you can't write history without at least paying attention to, pick something, you know, dandelions, smallpox, the wheat plant, and think about the story of our relationship to those things, because it's a really interesting, really complicated story.
Does environmental history have important lessons for the environmental movement?
I believe so. I've been working for a while now on a book called Saving Nature in Time, and the title is a pun. And it basically makes the argument that those mythic stories that we do like to tell ourselves and that have great power, and that I'd like to tell myself too, about a wondrously whole nature, that if only we could get back to it, the world would be good again. Well, that's not actually the way even nature without us looked like. That nature without us has a history too. And geology tells that story. Evolutionary biology tells that story. Asteroids have hit this planet. The species have gone extinct. There's some big dramatic stories that are part of that non-human past. So I would say one of the lessons for environmental politics is that when you start telling yourself a story that begins in a place of stasis and moves to a place of dynamism that looks bad or crisis, you should step back and ask yourself whether that story is too easy. One of the criticisms, and I'm a lifelong environmentalist, I do this work because I believe in building a sustainable human relationship to this world that we share with all those beings that I named earlier. One of the things I believe very, very strongly is that it's very easy to tell very dramatic stories about how human beings have affected the planet that lead to despair and lead us to say, we're just awful. The world would be a much better place if humanity would go extinct tomorrow. And although I get that emotion, I have felt that emotion. Many, many people who care about nature have felt that emotion. It's actually not a very useful emotion. I sure would not want to build a political movement or a cultural movement, a moral movement on despair. So I'm actually a great believer in complicated stories that have fearful things in them, but that also have some kind of vision of hope in them. And that's not a historical project. That's a moral project. It's a political project. And if you ask, so what does environmental history have to offer environmentalism, or to Americans who may not call themselves environmentalists, but they want to give a sustainable relationship to the world, to their children and grandchildren, then I think we need to tell complicated stories that don't just lead to despair. Though Pollyannish sentimental stories that say, oh, do whatever you want, it's all great, those are dangerous stories too. We need something in between.
So the interaction between nature and humanity, that story involves interactions that aren't going to go away, but by understanding this complex story, then you inform in choices about the environment.
Right. One of the lessons history teaches very deeply, very deeply, it's one of the core faiths of my discipline, is that we look at the world as it is today, and before we ask a historical question about it, it looks given. It looks natural. This is just the way the world is. And as soon as you ask the question, well, how did the world get to be this way? Suddenly, it's no longer a given thing. It's something that became this thing. And as you go back, as you start looking, what you start to realize, going to your question, is people made choices. The world as we now experience it is a product of human choice and actually choices by other organisms too, in a funny kind of way. And the more you learn that, the more you recognize, well, you know, we're making choices too. What choices should we be making? As we imagine the future, because we're writing history now too. People are going to be writing about us 100 years from now. What stories do we imagine them telling about us? And what stories would we like them to tell about us? That leads to a really interesting politics, I think.
One final question. As somebody who is committed to understanding the past and conveying that knowledge, information, and values to the present, but at the same time, you're very sensitive to how the world is changing, how nature is changing. So how would you advise students to prepare for the future?
Get liberally educated. We go back to it's an old-fashioned piece of advice. But one of the things I deeply, deeply believe is the more you know about the world, and I'm speaking passionately about the historian's frame here, but I'm nearly as passionate about the geologist's frame, the chemist's frame, the literary critic's frame. Those are all really, really not just valuable and necessary frames. They're really cool frames. They're really interesting. And so one thing I would say to a student is, don't work on boredom. Don't be bored. If you're bored by something, figure out why you're bored and figure out how not to be bored. If a liberal education, well-lived, does anything at all, it teaches us how not to move through the world as a boring place. And I think when people aren't bored and are generous in their curiosity, in their willingness to learn about another human being or another way of being in the world, I think that leads to good places. So don't be bored would be one of the things I'd offer as a lesson.
Well, on that note, Professor Cronin, I wanted to thank you for taking the time for this absolutely fascinating discussion.
Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.
And thank you very much for joining us for this Conversation with History.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.